Soon they were winding their way past shuttered shops and food stands. The clouds overhead were low and ominous, and the night smelled of the coming storm. A southwesterly wind blew in stiff but erratic gusts, pushing leaves and bits of paper around their ankles as they walked. When it started to drizzle, Sylvie raised the hood of her parka, but Fibbon left his own down. He did not mind wet hair half as much as having his sight and hearing obstructed now. Off toward the sea, he saw a flickering in the sky, accompanied by distant, gray growling.
Hell, Fibbon thought. What am I thinking?
He grabbed his companion's arm again.
Nobody's going to go to sea in this kind of weather, Sylvie.
The captain of this boat will, Fibbon.
She shook her head.
I really shouldn't tell you this, but he's a smuggler. Was, even before the war. His craft has foul weather integrity and can partially submerge.
Fibbon blinked.
What's he smuggling nowadays?
Sylvie looked left and right.
Chims, some of the times, to and from Silmar Island.
Silmar? Would he take us there?
Sylvie frowned.
I promised Galet I'd get you to the mountains, Fibbon, and anyway, I'm not sure I'd trust this captain that far.
But Fibbon's head was a whirl. Half the humans on the planet were interned on Silmar Island. Why settle for Robert and Athaclana, who were, after all, barely more than children, when he might be able to bring Galet's questions before the experts at the university?
Let's play it by ear,
he said noncommittally. But he was already determined to evaluate this smuggler captain for himself. Perhaps under the cover of this storm it might turn out to be possible. Fibbon thought about it as they resumed their journey. Soon they were near the docks, in fact not far from the spot where Fibbon had spent part of the afternoon watching the gulls. The rain now fell in sudden, unpredictable sheets. Each time it blew away again, the air was left startlingly clear, enhancing every odor, from decaying fish to the beery stink of a fisherman's tavern across the way, where a few lights still shone, and low, sad music leaked into the night. Fibbon's nostrils flared. He sniffed, trying to trace something that seemed to fade in and out with the fickle rain. Likewise, Fibbon's senses fed his imagination, laying out possibilities for his consideration. His companion led him around a corner, and Fibbon saw three piers. Several dark, bulky shadows lay moored next to each. One of those, no doubt, was the smuggler's boat. Fibbon stopped Sylvie, again with a hand on her arm.
"We'd better hurry,"
she urged.
"Wouldn't do to be too early," he replied. "It's going to be cramped and smelly in that boat. Come on back here. There's something we may not have a chance to do for some time."
She gave him a puzzled expression as he drew her back around the corner into the shadows. When he put his arms around her, she stiffened, then relaxed and tilted her face up. Fibbon kissed her. Sylvie answered in kind. When he started using his lips to nibble from her left ear across the line of her jaw and down her neck, Sylvie sighed.
"Oh, Fibbon, if only we had time, if only you knew how much—"
"Shh,"
he told her as he let go. With a flourish, he took off his parka and laid it on the ground.
"What?"
she began, but he drew her down to sit on the jacket. He settled down behind her. Her tension eased a bit when he began combing his fingers through her hair, grooming her.
"Whoosh,"
Sylvie said.
"For a moment I thought—"
"Who, me? You should know me better than that, darling. I'm the kind who likes to build up slowly. None of this rush-rush stuff. We can take our time."
She turned her head to smile up at him.
"I'm glad. I won't be pink for a week, anyway. Though, I mean, we don't really have to wait that long. It's just—"
Her words cut short suddenly as Fibbins' left arm tightened hard around her throat. In a flash, he reached into her parka and clicked open her pocket knife. Sylvie's eyes bulged as he pressed the sharp blade close against her carotid artery. "One word," he whispered directly into her left ear. "One sound, and you feed the gulls tonight, do you understand?" She nodded jerkily. He could feel her pulse pound, the vibration carrying up the knife blade. Fibbins' own heart was not beating much slower. "Mouth your words," he told her hoarsely. "I'll lip-read. Now tell me, where are tracers planted?" Sylvie blinked. Aloud, she said,
"What?"
That was all. Her voice stopped as he instantly increased pressure.
"Try again,"
he whispered. This time she formed the words silently.
"What are you talking about, Fibbin?"
His own voice was a barely audible murmur in her ear.
"They're waiting for us out there, aren't they, darling? And I don't mean fairy tale chim smugglers. I'm talking goobru sweets. You're leading me right into their fine feathered clutches."
Sylvie stiffened.
"Fibbin, I... No, no, Fibbin." "I smell bird," he hissed. "They're out there, all right. And as soon as I picked up that scent, it all suddenly made perfect sense."
Sylvie remained silent. Her eyes were eloquent enough by themselves.
"Oh, Galet must think I'm a prize sap. Now that I think on it, of course the escape must have been arranged. In fact, the date must have been set for some time. You all probably didn't count on this storm tying up the fishing fleet. That tale about a smuggler captain was a resourceful ad lib to push back my suspicions. Did you think of it yourself, Sylvie?"
"Fibbin,
shut up." "Oh, it was appealing, all right, to imagine some chims were smart enough to be pulling runs to Silmar and back, right under the enemy's beak. Vanity almost won, Sylvie, but I was once a scout pilot, remember? I started thinking about how hard that'd be to pull off, even in weather like this."
He sniffed the air, and there it was again, that distinct, musty odor. Now that he thought about it, he realized that none of the tests he and Galet had been put through during the last several weeks had dealt with a sense of smell.
"Of course not. Galactics think it's mostly a relic for animals."
Moisture fell onto his hand, even though it was not raining just then. Sylvie's tears dripped. She shook her head.
"You won't be harmed, Fibbin. The suzerain just wants to ask you some questions. Then you'll be let go. It promised."
So this was just another test after all.
Fibbin felt like laughing at himself for ever believing escape was possible.
"I guess I'll see Galet again sooner than I thought."
He was beginning to feel ashamed of the way he had terrorized Sylvie. After all, this had all been just a game, anyway. Simply one more examination. It wouldn't do to take anything too seriously under such conditions. She was only doing her job. He started to relax, easing his grip on her throat, when suddenly part of what Sylvie had said struck Fibbin.
"Suzerain said it had let me go?" he whispered. "You mean... it'll send me back to jail, don't you?"
She shook her head vigorously.
No,
she mouthed.
"It'll drop us off in the mountains. I meant that part of my deal with you and Galet. The suzerain promised, if you answer its questions..."
"Wait a minute," Fibbin snapped. "You aren't talking about the suzerain of propriety, are you?"
She shook her head. Fibbin felt suddenly lightheaded.
"Which?" Which suzerain is waiting for us out there?
Sylvie sniffed.
The suzerain of constant caution, she whispered.
He closed his eyes in the dreadful realization of what this meant. This was no game or test, after all.
Oh, good all, he thought.
Now he had to think to save his own neck. If it had been the suzerain of Beam and Talon, Fibbon would have been ready to throw in the towel right then and there, for then all of the resources of the Gubru military machine would have been arrayed against him. As it was, the chances were slim enough, but Fibbon was starting to get ideas.
Accountants, insurance agents, bureaucrats.
Those made up the army of the suzerain of cost and caution.
Maybe, Fibbon thought, just maybe.
Before doing anything, though, he had to deal with Sylvie. He couldn't just tie her up and leave her, and he simply wasn't a bloody-minded killer. That led to only one option. He had to win her cooperation, and quickly. He might tell her of his certainty that the suzerain of cost and caution wasn't quite the stickler for truth the suzerain of propriety was. When it was its word against hers, why should the bird keep any promise to release them? In fact, tonight's raid on its pier might even be illegal by the invader's standards, in which case it would be stupid to let two chims who knew about it run around free. Knowing the Gubru, Fibbon figured the suzerain of cost and caution would probably let them go all right, straight out of the airlock into deep space.
Would she believe me, though, if I told her?
He couldn't chance that. Fibbon thought he knew another way to get Sylvie's undivided attention.
I want you to listen to me carefully, he told her. I am not going out to meet your suzerain. I am not going out there for one simple reason. If I walk out there knowing what I now know, you and I can kiss my white card goodbye.
Her eyes locked onto his. A tremor ran down her spine.
You see, darling, I have to behave like a superlative example to chimpdom in order to qualify for that encomium. And what kind of super chimp goes and walks right into something he already knows is a trap? No, Sylvie. We'll probably still get caught anyway. But we've got to be caught trying our very best to escape, or it just won't count. You see what I mean?
She blinked a few times and finally nodded.
Hey,
he whispered amiably.
Cheer up. You should be glad I saw through this stunt. It just means our kid'll be all the more clever, a little bastard. He'll probably find a way to blow up his kindergarten.
Sylvie blinked. Hesitantly, she smiled.
Yeah, she said quietly. I guess that's right.
Fibbon let his knife hand drop away and released Sylvie's throat. He stood up. This was the moment of truth. All she probably had to do was let out a shout, and the followers of the suzerain of cost and caution would be on them in moments. Instead, though, she pulled off her ring watch and handed it to Fibbon.
The tracer.
He nodded and offered her his hand to help her rise. She stumbled at first, still trembling from reaction, but he kept his arm around her as he led her back one block and a little south.
Now, if only this idea works, he thought.
The Dovecote was where he remembered it, behind an ill-kempt group house in the neighborhood bordering the harbor. Everyone was asleep, apparently. But Fibbon nevertheless kept quiet as possible as he cut a few wires and crept into the coop. It was dank and smelled uncomfortably of bird. The pigeon's soft cooing reminded Fibbon of Quacko.
"Come on, kids," he whispered to them. "You're going to help me fool your cousins tonight."
He had recalled this place from one of his walks. The proximity was more than convenient. It was probably essential. He and Sylvie dared not leave the harbor area until they had disposed of the tracer. The pigeons edged away from him. While Sylvie kept watch, Fibbon cornered and seized a fat, strong-looking bird. With a piece of string, he bound the ringwatch to its foot.
"Nice night for a long flight, don't you think?"
he whispered, and threw the pigeon into the air. He repeated the process with his own watch for good measure. He left the door open. If the birds returned early, the Gubru might follow the tracer signal here, but their typically noisy arrival would send the whole flock flapping off again, starting another wild goose chase. Fibbon congratulated himself on his cleverness as he and Sylvie ran eastward, away from the harbor. Soon they were in a dilapidated industrial area. Fibbon knew where he was. He had been here before, leading the placid horse, Tycho, on his first foray into town after the invasion. Sometime before they reached the wall, he signaled for a stop. He had to catch his breath, though Sylvie seemed hardly winded at all.
"Well, she's a dancer, of course," he thought. "Okay, now we strip," he told her.
To her credit, Sylvie did not even bat an eye. The logic was inescapable. Her watch might not have been the only tracer planted on their person. She hurried through the disrobing and was finished before him. When everything lay in a pile, Fibbon spared her a brief, appreciative whistle. Sylvie blushed.
"Now what?"
she asked.
"Now we go for the fence," he answered. "The fence? But Fibbon, come on. I've wanted to look at the thing close up for some time anyway."
It was only a few hundred yards farther before they reached the broad strip of ground the aliens had leveled all the way around Port Helena. Sylvie shivered as they approached the tall barrier, which glistened damply under the light of bright watch globes placed at wide intervals along its length.
"Fibbon,"
Sylvie said as he stepped out onto the strip.
"We can't go out there."
"Why not?" he asked. Still, he stopped and turned to look back at her.
"Do you know anyone who has?"
She shook her head.
"Why would anybody? It's obviously crazy. Those watch globes."
"Yeah," Fibbon said contemplatively.
"I was just wondering how many of them it took to line a fence around the whole city. 10,000? 20? 30?
He was remembering the Guardian drones that had lined a much smaller and much more sensitive perimeter around the former Timbrimi embassy, that day when the Chancery building exploded and Fibbon had had his lesson in E.T. humor. Those devices had turned out to be pretty unimpressive compared with Rover, or the typical battle robot the Gubru Talon soldiers took into battle.
"I wonder about these," he thought,
and took another step forward.
"Fibbon!"
Sylvie sounded close to panic.
"Let's try the gate. We can tell the guards. We can tell them we were robbed. We were hicks from the farms, visiting town, and somebody stole our clothes and ID cards. If we act dumb enough, maybe they'll just let us through."
"Yeah, sure." Fibbon stepped closer still. Now he stood no more than half a dozen meters from the barrier. He saw that it comprised a series of narrow slats connected by wire at the top and bottom. He had chosen a point between two of the glowing globes, as far from each as possible. Still, as he approached, he felt a powerful sensation that they were watching him. The certainty filled Fibbon with resignation. By now, of course, Gubru soldiery were on their way here. They would arrive any minute now. His best course was to turn around, to run.
Now!
He glanced back at Sylvie. She stood where he had left her. It was easy to tell that she would rather be almost anywhere else in the world than here. He wasn't at all sure why she had remained. Fibbon grabbed his left wrist with his right hand. His pulse was fast and thready, and his mouth felt dry as sand. Trembling, he made an effort of will and took another step toward the fence. An almost palpable dread seemed to close in all around him, as he had felt when he heard poor Simon Levin's death wail during that useless, futile battle out in space. He felt a dark foreboding of imminent doom. Mortality pressed in, a sense of the futility of life. Bibin turned around slowly to look at Sylvie. He grinned.
"Cheap chicken shit birds," he grunted. "They aren't watch globes at all. They're stupid psi radiators."
Sylvie blinked. Her mouth opened. Closed.
"Are you sure?"
she asked unbelievingly.
"Come on out and see," he urged. "Right there, you'll suddenly be sure you're being watched. Then you'll think every Talon soldier in space is coming after you."
Sylvie swallowed. She clenched her fists and moved out onto the empty strip. Step by step, Fibbin watched her. He had to give Sylvie credit. A lesser chimney would have cut and run, screaming, long before she reached his position. Beads of perspiration popped out on her brow, joining the intermittent raindrops. Part of him, distant from the adrenaline roar, appreciated her naked form. It helped to distract his mind.
"So, he really has nursed."
The faint stretch marks of childbearing and lactation were often faked by some chimneys in order to make themselves look more attractive. But in this case, it was clear that Sylvie had borne a child.
"I wonder what her story is."
When she stood next to him, eyes closed tightly, she whispered,
"What? What's happening to me right now?"
Bibin listened to his own feelings. He thought of Galet and her long mourning for her friend and protector, the giant Chim Max. He thought of the Chims he had seen blown apart by the enemy's overpowering weaponry. He remembered Simon.
"You feel like your best friend in all the world just died," he told her gently and took her hand.
Her answering grip was hard, but across her face there swept a look of relief.
"Psi emitters. That's all?"
She opened her eyes.
Why those cheap chicken shit birds?"
Fibbin guffawed. Sylvie slowly smiled. With her free hand, she covered her mouth. They laughed, standing there in the rain in the midst of a riverbed of sorrow. They laughed, and when their tears finally slowed, they walked together the rest of the way to the fence, still holding hands.
"Now, when I say push, push."
"I'm ready, Fibbin."
Sylvie crouched beneath him, feet set, shoulder braced against one of the tall slats, arms gripping the part of the wall next to it. Standing over her, Fibbin took a similar stance and planted his feet in the mud. He took several deep breaths.
"Okay, push."
Together they heaved. The slats were already a few centimeters apart. As he and Sylvie strained, he could feel the space begin to widen.
"Evolution is never wasted,"
Fibbin thought as he heaved with all his might. A million years ago, humans were going through all the pangs of self-uplift, evolving what the Galactics said could only be given, sapiency, the ability to think and to covet the stars. Meanwhile, though, Fibbin's ancestors had not been idle.
"We were getting strong."
Fibbin concentrated on that thought while sweat popped out on his brow and the plastisheath slats groaned. He grunted and could feel Sylvie's own desperate struggle as her back quivered against his leg.
"Ah!"
Sylvie lost her footing in the mud and her legs flew out, throwing her backward, hard. Recoil spun Fibbin about, and the springy slats bounced back, tossing him on top of her. For a minute or two, they just lay there, breathing in shuddering gasps. Finally, though, Sylvie spoke.
"Please, honey, not tonight. I got a headache."
Thibbett laughed. He rolled off of her and onto his back, coughing. They needed humor. It was their best defense against the constant hammering of the psi globes. Panic was incipient, ever creeping on the verge of their minds. Laughter kept it at bay. They helped each other up and inspected what they had accomplished. The gap was noticeably larger, perhaps 10 centimeters now, but it was still far from wide enough, and Fibbon knew they were running out of time. They would need at least 3 hours to have any hope of reaching the foothills before daybreak. At least, if they made it through, they would have the storm on their side. Another sheet of rain swept across them as he and Sylvie settled in again, bracing themselves. The lightning had drawn closer over the last half hour. Thunder rolled, shaking trees and rattling shutters. "It's a mixed blessing," Fibbon thought. For, while it no doubt hampered Gubru's scanners, the rain also made it hard to get a good grip on the slippery fence material. The mud was a curse.
"You ready?" he asked.
"Sure, you could manage to keep that thing of yours out of my face,"
Sylvie said, looking up at him.
"It's distracting, you know."
"It's what you told Galet you wanted to share, honey. Besides, you've seen it all before, back at the Thunder Mound."
"Yes,"
she smiled.
"But it didn't look quite the same."
"Oh, shut up and push,"
Fibbon growled. Together they heaved again, putting all their strength into the effort.
Give way," he heard Sylvie gasp,
and his own muscles threatened to cramp as the fence material creaked, budged ever so slightly, and creaked again. This time, it was Fibbon who slipped, letting the springy material bounce back. Once more, they collapsed together in the mud, panting. The rain was steady now. Fibbon wiped a rivulet out of his eyes and looked at the gap again.
"Maybe 12 centimeters. Ifni, that's not anywhere near enough."
He could feel the captivating power of the psi globes broadcasting their gloom into his skull. The message was sapping his strength, he knew, pushing him and Sylvie toward resignation. He felt terribly heavy as he slowly stood up and leaned against the obdurate fence.
"Hell, we tried. We'll get credit for that much. Almost made it, too, if only..."
"No,"
he shouted suddenly.
"No, I won't let you."
He hurled himself at the gap, tried to pry his body through, wriggled and writhed against the recalcitrant opening. Lightning struck somewhere in the dark realm just beyond, illuminating an open countryside of fields and forests, and beyond them, the beckoning foothills of the Mulan Range. Thunder pealed, setting the fence rocking. The slats squeezed Fibbon between them, and he howled in agony. When they let go, he fell, half-numbed with pain, to the ground near Sylvie. But he was on his feet again in an instant. Another electric ladder lit the glowering clouds. He screamed back at the sky. He beat the ground. Mud and pebbles flew up as he threw handfuls into the air. More thunder drove the stones back, pelting them into his face. There was no longer any such thing as speech, no words. The part of him that knew such things reeled in shock, and in reaction other, older, sturdier portions took control. Now there was only the storm, the wind and rain, the lightning and thunder. He beat his breast, lips curled back, baring his teeth to the stinging rain. The storm sang to Fibbon, reverberating in the ground and the throbbing air. He answered with a howl. This music was no prissy human thing. It was not poetical, like the whale dream phantoms of the dolphins, no. This was music he could feel clear down to his bones. It rocked him. It rolled him.
It lifted Fibbin like a rag doll and tossed him down into the mud. He came back up, spinning and hooting. He could feel Sylvie's gaze upon him. She was slapping the ground, watching him, wide-eyed, excited. That only made him beat his breast harder and shriek louder. He knew he was not drooping now. Throwing pebbles into the air, he cried defiance to the storm, calling out for the lightning to come and get him. Obligingly, it came. Brilliance filled space, charging it, sending his hair bristling outward, sparking. The soundless bellow blew him backward, like a giant's hand come down to slap him straight against the wall. Fibbin screamed as he struck the slats. Before he blacked out, he distinctly smelled the aroma of burning fur.
Chapter 66 Galet. In the darkness, with the sound of rain pelting against the roof tiles, she suddenly opened her eyes. Alone, she stood up with the blanket wrapped around her and went to the window. Outside, a storm blew across Port Helena, announcing the full arrival of autumn. The caliginous clouds rumbled angrily, threateningly. There was no view to the east, but Galet let her cheek rest against the cool glass and face that way anyway. The room was comfortably warm. Nevertheless, she closed her eyes and shivered against a sudden chill. Chapter 67 Fibbin
Eyes. Eyes. Eyes were everywhere.
They whirled and danced, glowing in the darkness, taunting him. An elephant appeared, crashing through the jungle, trumpeting with red irises aflame. He tried to flee, but it caught him, picked him up in its trunk, and carried him off, bouncing, jouncing him, cracking his ribs. He wanted to tell the beast to go ahead and eat him already, or trample him, only to get it over with. After a while, though, he grew used to it. The pain dulled to a throbbing ache, and the journey settled into a steady rhythm. The first thing he realized, on awakening, was that the rain was somehow missing his face. He lay on his back on what felt like grass. All around him the sounds of the storm rolled on, scarcely diminished. He could feel the wet showers on his legs and torso, and yet none of the raindrops fell onto his nose or mouth. Fibbin opened his eyes to look and see why, and, incidentally, to find out how he happened to be alive. A silhouette blocked out the dim underglow of the clouds. A lightning stroke, not far away, briefly illuminated a face above his own. Sylvie looked down in concern, holding his head in her lap. Fibbin tried to speak.
Where?
But the word came out as a croak. Most of his voice seemed to be gone. Fibbin dimly recalled an episode of screaming, howling at the sky. That had to be why his throat hurt so.
"We're outside,"
Sylvie said, just loud enough to be heard over the rain. Fibbin blinked.
"Outside?"
Wincing, he lifted his head just enough to look around. Against the stormy backdrop, it was hard to see anything at all, but he was able to make out the dim shapes of trees and low rolling hills. He turned to his left. The outline of Port Helena was unmistakable, especially the curving trail of tiny lights that followed the course of the Gubru fence.
But how did we get here?
I carried you, she said matter-of-factly. You weren't in much shape for walking after you tore down that wall.
Tore down?
She nodded. There appeared to be a shining light in Sylvie's eyes.
I thought I'd seen thunder dances before, Fibbin Bulger, but that was one to beat all others on record. I swear it, if I live to 90 and have 100 respectful grandchildren, I don't imagine I'll ever be able to tell it so I'll be believed.
Dimly, it sort of came back to him now.
He recalled the anger, the outrage over having come so close and yet so far from freedom. It shamed him to remember giving in that way to frustration, to the animal within him. "Some white card," Pippin snorted. Knowing how stupid the suzerain of propriety had to be to have chosen a chim like him for such a role.
"I must have lost my grip for a while."
Sylvie touched his left shoulder. He winced and looked down to see a nasty burn there. Oddly, it did not seem to hurt as badly as a score of lesser aches and bruises.
"You taunted the storm, Pippin," she said in a hushed voice. "Dared it to come down after you, and when it came, you made it do your bidding."
Pippin closed his eyes.
"Oh, good all, of all the silly superstitious nonsense."
And yet there was a part of him, deep down, that felt warmly satisfied. It was as if that portion actually believed that there had been cause and effect, that he had done exactly what Sylvie described. Pippin shuddered.
"Help me sit up, okay?"
There was a disorienting moment or two as the horizon tilted and vision swam. At last, though, when she had him seated so the world no longer wavered all around him, he gestured for her to help him stand.
"You should rest, Pippin."
"When we reach the Mulan," he told her, "dawn can't be far off, and the storm won't last forever. Come on, I'll lean on you."
She took his good arm over her shoulder, bracing him. Somehow they managed to get him onto his feet.
"You know," he said, "you're a strong little chimney. Huh. Carried me all the way up here, did you?"
She nodded, looking up at him with that same light. Pippin smiled.
"Okay," he said. "Pretty damn okay."
Together they started out, limping toward the glowering dark hummocks to the east. Part 5. Avengers. In ancient days, when Poseidon still reigned and the ships of man were as weak as tinder, bad luck struck a certain Thracian freighter, who foundered and broke apart under an early winter storm. All hands were lost under those savage waves, save one, the boat's mascot, a monkey. As the fates would have it, a dolphin appeared just as the monkey was gasping its last breath. Knowing of the great love between man and dolphin, the monkey cried out, "Save me, for the sake of my poor children in Athens!" Quick as a streak, the dolphin offered its broad back.
"Thou art very strange, small and ugly for a man," the dolphin said, as the monkey took a desperate grip.
"As men go, I might be quite handsome," replied the monkey, who coughed, holding on tightly as the dolphin turned towards land.
"You say you are a man of Athens?"
the wary sea creature asked.
"Indeed, who would claim it were he not?" the monkey proclaimed.
"Then you know Piraeus?"
the suspicious dolphin inquired further.
The monkey thought quickly. "Oh, yes," he cried. "Piraeus is my dear friend. I only spoke with him last week."
With that, the dolphin bucked angrily and flung the monkey into the sea to drown. The moral of the story, one might suppose, is that one should always get one's story straight when pretending to be what one is not. M. N. Plano. Chapter 68. Galactics. The image in the holographic display flickered. That was not surprising, since it came from many parsecs away, refracted through the folded space of the Poorman transfer point. The muddy picture wavered, and occasionally lost definition. Still, to the suzerain of propriety, the message was coming in all too clearly. A diverse collection of beings stood depicted before the suzerain's pedestal. It recognized most of the races by sight. There was a Pila, for instance, short, furry, and stubby-armed. And there was a tall, gangling Zatang, who stood beside a spider-like Serentin. A Bigli glowered lazily, coiled next to a being the suzerain did not immediately recognize, and which might have been a client or a decorative pet. Also, to the suzerain's dismay, the delegation included a Cynthian and a human. A human! And there was no way to complain. It was only appropriate to include a Terran among the official observers, if a qualified human were available, since this world was registered to the Wolflings. But the suzerain had felt certain that there were none employed by the Uplift Institute in this sector. Perhaps this was one more sign that the political situation in the five galaxies had worsened. Word had come from the homeworld Roostmasters, telling of serious setbacks out between the spiral arms. Battles had gone badly. Allies had proven unreliable. Tandu and Soro fleets dominated once profitable trade routes, and now monopolized the siege of Earth. These were trying times for the great and powerful clan of the Guxiu Gubru. All now depended on certain important neutralist patron lines. Should something happen to draw one or two of them into an alliance, triumph might yet be attained for the righteous. On the other side of the wing, it would be disastrous to see any of the neutrals turn against the great clan. To influence such matters had been a major reason, back when the suzerain of propriety originated the idea of invading Garth in the first place. Superficially, this expedition had been intended to seize hostages for use in prying secrets out of the high command of Earth. But psychological profiles had always made success in that seem unlikely. Wolflings were obstinate creatures. No, what had won the Roostmasters over to the priest's proposal was the possibility that this would bring honor to the cause of the clan, to score a coup and win new alliances from wavering parties. And at first all seemed to go so well. The first suzerain of cost and caution. The priest chirped a deep note of mourning. It had not before realized what wisdom they had lost, how the old bureaucrat had tempered the rash brilliance of the younger two with deep and reliable sense.
What a consensus, unity, policy we might have had!
Now, though, in addition to the constant struggles among the still disunited triumvirate, there was this latest bad news. A Terran would be among the official observers from the Uplift Institute. The implications were unpleasant to consider. And that was not the worst of it. As the suzerain watched in dismay, the Earthling stepped forward as spokesman. Its statement was in clear Galactic 7. Greetings to the triumvirate of the forces of Guxiu Gubru, now in contested occupation of the limited leasehold world known as Garth. I greet you in the name of Cochwin III, Grand High Examiner of the Uplift Institute. This message is being sent ahead of our vessel by the quickest available means, so that you may prepare for our arrival. Conditions in hyperspace and at transfer points indicate that causality will almost certainly allow us to attend the proposed ceremonies and administer appropriate sapiency tests at the time and place requested by you. You are further informed that Galactic Uplift Institute has gone to great lengths to accommodate your unusual request, first in exercising such haste, and second, in acting on the basis of so little information. Ceremonies of uplift are joyous occasions, especially in times of turmoil such as these. They celebrate the continuity and perpetual renewal of galactic culture in the name of the most revered progenitors. Client species are the hope, the future of our civilization, and on such occasions as this, we demonstrate our responsibility, our honor, and our love. We approach this event, then, filled with curiosity as to what wonder the clan of Guxiu Gubru plans to unveil before the five galaxies.